This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, Tony Hale, has won 2 Emmy Awards for his performance on HBO's comedy series Veep. He plays Gary Walsh, the personal aide to Selina Meyer, the vice president who last season inherited the White House after the president resigned. Hale also co-starred in Arrested Development as Buster, the youngest of the Bluth siblings. Veep is about political rivalries, power plays, and gaffes. And there are plenty of gaffes, since Selina and much of her staff are pretty inept. Last season, Selina Meyer ran for president, hoping to stay in the White House, but the election ended in an Electoral College tie. This season, her attention turned to the recount and to the House of Representatives, which is supposed to decide the outcome in the event of a tie. Meanwhile, Gary, who has been with Selina for years, remains loyal to Selina, whom he worships and fawns over. He carries her oversized handbag, nicknamed the Leviathan, which now holds the nuclear code. He's always standing right behind her, reminding her of the names of the people she's greeting and suggesting things she might say to them. He even chooses clothes for her. In this scene, from earlier this season, Selina's mother is in the hospital and critically ill, but all Selina can think about is the recount. In order to have a quiet space, Selina, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Gary go to the hospital chapel.
Do you pray?
A lot.
What do you pray for?
You know. Maybe want to try it?
Sure. You know, what the hell? We're here, right?
Okay, all right. Yeah. Okay.
God,
God, it's me, Selina.
Oh, Lord God, it's me, Selina. Grant me wisdom and strength.
Give us your comforting presence.
I've got it now, I've got it. Lord God, please ease my mother's pain and suffering.
Yes, Lord, yes, Lord.
Ease her passing. Ease it all. Ease it down the... Lord, let her daughter, thy humble servant, be the first woman elected president of the United States. Please, this is so much to bear.
Oh, it is, Lord, it is.
Hear my prayer.
Hear her prayer.
Lift me up. Lift me up, because heel is stuck in this thing. Yeah, I got it.
Tony Hale, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe your character of Gary.
Oh, sweet Gary. Gary has been with the president for many, many years, and he's what's called a body man. What he does is he pretty much carries around a bag and anything she needs, like it could be Purell or pens or her speech or other things, is in this bag, and so he's always by her side. And typically, before we started the shooting the pilot, we were able to meet people who had done this role just to kind of find out about their life. And I met a guy who was a body man, and he did it in his 20s, and he did it for a couple of years, and then burned out and moved on to other stuff. My character has done it into his 40s because he has no identity outside of Selina Meyer, and he worships her. She is so verbally abusive to him, but he doesn't hear it. He just bounces back like, you know, some kind of domestic abuse situation. And he is perfectly content where he is.
So I never heard the expression body man until I started watching Veep. Is that the word that's actually used in Washington for people who follow around? Do only women in politics have a body man?
No, both men and women do. It's either called, there's two ways of saying it. There's either a body man or a bag man. But typically body man is the term used. Like Reggie Love was Obama's at a time. And so each famous politician will have one.
But Obama doesn't have a giant handbag like President Meyer does.
yeah. Well, they typically carry around some kind of bag to kind of whatever they need.
An attaché or something.
Yes, exactly. In my character, the horror is if he runs out of anything in his bag, that is just an absolute nightmare. So he's got like Costco versions at home of what's in his bag because God forbid he runs out and gets abused again.
So your character hardly talks. He's usually just like whispering lines to Selena. Yeah. So what does your script look like? When you get your script, does it say, Gary, parentheses, looks pained, Gary, parentheses, winces, Gary, parentheses, looks confused? Like what, because you don't always have lines, but you're on camera a lot and you're conveying a lot through your facial expressions and your body posture.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely, they give me kind of a lot of fun lines and tidbits to play with and to kind of react off of her. However, there's times, because which is very special to this show that I've never experienced before, they do give us this 2 weeks of rehearsal time before we shoot. And so in that time, since I'm always standing behind her, I can kind of play with, you know, how would I react to that, or, you know, make odd noises. I mean, Gary's like big on, like, all of a sudden he'll just go, he just makes these really awkward noises behind her, which I'm sure is so annoying. But so it's fun to kind of play with that and just to kind of have that life behind her. But I mean, what's crazy is, you know, she's in the public eye, and there's stuff that she can't react a certain way or say certain things in public. But it's wild that I'm standing behind her and I've got the worst poker face. Like I'm having the most of, my reactions are kind of saying what she wants to say sometimes. Like I'm just looking at somebody deadpan or thinking they're an idiot, or, and I just freely react. And it's amazing that I still have this job, because anybody else would be fired.
So on Arrested Development, you played a character who has similarities to your character on Veep in the sense that they're both kind of under the spell of a very dominant woman. In the case of Veep, it's Selena Meyer, the vice president, now president. But in the case of Arrested Development, it was his mother, who, she wasn't president, but she was a kind of very snobbish, controlling socialite. So let's hear a scene from Arrested Development. And this is a scene from season one, and your character is Buster, and you've gone out with your mom to a fancy event, but she's forced you to leave your eyeglasses at home because she says you look better without them. Meantime, during the event, a woman writes you a note propositioning you. You don't know who the woman is because you only saw a blurry figure without your glasses, but you're so excited that that a woman is paying attention to you. And so neither you nor your mother realize that this woman who sent you the note is actually your mother's rival. You know, she's your mother's age, she's her rival, and she's played in the series by Liza Minnelli. So you're so excited that you got this note that you're already in love with her, even though you have no idea who she is. And your mother, who's played by Jessica Walter, is very upset by this. And so in this scene, your mother, your brother Michael, played by Jason Bateman, and you are all talking about this, and your mother speaks first.
Buster's out of control.
What do you mean, another panic attack?
Me? No, she's just wigged out because I have a girlfriend.
Oh, waiter hands him a note. Suddenly, Steve McQueen. He doesn't even know what she looks like.
I know she's a brownish area, with points, and I know I love her.
I'm calling Dr. Miller.
Okay, I don't know I love her, but I cannot tell you how liberating it is to be with someone who's not mom, who's nothing like her.
Yeah, and you're just jumping right into this, huh?
Oh, yes. Yes. That's what you do when life hands you a chance to be with someone special. You just grab that brownish area by its points, and you don't let go no matter what your mom says.
Oh my, I haven't heard that in a while.
Because of the similarities that we've discussed between the two characters, do you ever wonder, why do I get roles representing a character who can't differentiate himself from a parental figure?
I guess I just do emasculated and meek very well. definitely the two characters that have gotten the most, I guess, attention, there's some similarities there.
So your wife won an Emmy Award as a makeup artist. Did she ever do your makeup?
She did not in New York. We didn't meet that way in New York. We actually met at church. But she now in LA, if I'm doing stuff for where I need makeup for an interview or something like that, she'll do that, and it's great. We love working together.
How did you meet at church?
She was a makeup artist on Saturday Night Live at the time, and we were going to this church called Redeemer Presbyterian in New York. And I actually, it wasn't at the church. It was this, I had started this kind of, my friend and I actually had started this group called The Haven, where we had met a lot of people who were artists whose faith was important to them, but they maybe weren't necessarily supported by their church back home, or they weren't maybe supported by the Christian community with what they were doing. And my parents were very, my parents were very supportive. But we just kind of started this group where we kind of went to see each other's work and just hung out, and she had come to that, and we met and just kind of hit it off.
Do you still practice faith the way you were brought up, or did you try to redefine what faith meant to you as an adult?
I think any time in someone's faith journey, my faith journey also, you go through doubting, you go through, I think you kind of have to go through that, honestly, just to ask the tough questions. And so I think, yeah, there's always been some redefining it. I don't know about redefining it is the right word, but just making it more mine rather than maybe something I grew up with. Because I was raised in the South, and I was raised in the Baptist church. It's everything to me. It's incredibly, to walk through this, I mean, life is crazy. And to know that, honestly, a loving God is walking through it with me is very comforting for me. But yeah, I mean, I've been through my own times of just like, what does this mean? And how can this mean this? And ask the questions. And I've thankfully had a lot of people around me who have allowed me to ask those questions. And we've talked about it and walked through it together and struggled through it. And man, that's very, very important. And it's important to have those people around you can be honest with.
So like a lot of actors, you got your start in commercials. Does it pay well to do commercials?
Yeah, I had a lot of jobs in New York. I cater-waitered and did commercials and temped. And then it got to a place where I was getting enough commercials that I was able to pay my rent through it from it. So yeah, at the time it did. New York was a very, very expensive place to live, and it afforded me to live in this little studio I had.
You also got some tiny parts on big shows. Like, for example, in The Sopranos, you played a medical worker who's giving chemo to Uncle Junior.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it was a speaking role, but like you're so close yet so far away with a role like that.
But I was so excited to get it. I remember because I did that and I did this little part on Sex and the City and I was so ecstatic because I was doing commercials, loving doing commercials, but you know, the TV roles were not happening. And so getting that, I was very nervous. And I played on Sex and the City, I played this photographer's assistant. And I remember I just had to stand, or I was sitting next to the photographer, and I just kind of had to look like with these googly eyes on Kim Cattrall, who was having photographs taken. And so maybe I gave some kind of weird look, which I guess is my forte.
You've said in the past that you used to be worried at parties, that you'd be asked, so what do you do for a living? And if you didn't have a role booked, you wouldn't know what to say, and you wouldn't know how to present yourself. Can you talk a little bit about the anxieties that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's my favorite topic. I mean, there's a reason I do anxiety, anxious characters. It comes from a lot of personal anxiety.
Does it?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, I remember being in New York and thinking like, oh, I want to have something in my back pocket to be able to talk about. And if like 3 or 4 months had gone by since doing the job, I'd be like, oh, that's too much time to bring that up in conversation. So you wanted to have something relevant. And I just remember doing that a lot, which is a bummer, you know, which is a bummer because I think in this business, you get the question of like, what's next for you? What's next for you? What's next for you? And it can get you so focused on that, oh God, I have to have something coming up or I have to have something that you can, because you don't kind of go up to a dentist and say, what's next for you? Oh, well, I'm doing this molar and I'm, you know, I might do a cavity. You know, it's like there's, since we're freelancers, people are curious, which I think is great, but you kind of always maybe want to have something in your arsenal to say, oh, this is, I don't think it's right, but in your head, actors can be like, oh, I want to have something coming up or having just done something to have something to talk about, which is a really unfortunate way of thinking.
I guess it's the opposite of being in the moment.
It's opposite of being in the moment. And I, honestly, that, when I was on Arrested Development, I really learned a massive lesson from Arrested Development because here's a show that was so well-written and so funny and the cast was so great and I really did love being there, but I remember getting it and it's all I ever wanted and I remember it not satisfying the way I thought it was going to satisfy. And it really freaked me out because it was my dream. It was my dream to be on a sitcom. And I look back and I think even though New York was great and I had a fantastic support system and I did get all these commercial jobs, I don't think I was very present. I don't think I was very in the moment. And I always looked, whatever happened, I was like, oh, that sitcom's coming. That sitcom's coming. And I was so always far ahead. And then when I got it and I'd given that thing so much weight and it didn't satisfy, it really woke me up that if you're not practicing contentment where you are, you're not going to be content when you get what you want. And it really scared me. And it actually really woke me up when my daughter was born right after Arrested Development, because if there's anything a baby does is you have to be present because you got to keep it alive. And it really gave me an opportunity to kind of assess some things and look back at my life and be like, I just have not been very present. And since then, you know, through just kind of walking through that kind of awareness and therapy, just it's practicing being present has made things richer for me, honestly. I kind of suck at it. I'm getting better at it. I'm not great at it, but I'm trying to work on it.
Do you consider prayer a kind of exercise in being present and in kind of focusing your mind on the present and on something outside of yourself?
Yes, I do. I think prayerful meditation, being still in a space, being still with God, I don't do that enough. And it's crazy because when I do it, I always walk away from it going, why the hell am I not doing that more? Because it's so centering and it broadens just the picture of life, really. I mean, you just kind of go, we're spinning on a planet here, and I'm giving a lot of anxiety and a lot of weight to stuff that it just doesn't matter. And it's so focusing. And so even having this talk with you, it's like, yeah, I need to get back to that. I need to do that a lot more than I'm doing.
So you've talked about having personal anxiety like the characters that you're famous for. What are some of the ways that anxiety has manifested itself over the years? Like, do you get, like, nervous ailments or...?
When I was younger, I would get panic attacks. Because many times when those thoughts or feelings came in, I would identify with all of them when I was younger. And I'd be like, oh, my God, this is a lot, you know? But as you get old, as I've gotten older, being able to separate that from myself and being able to like, oh, yeah, there's that crazy thought. There's that feeling. And not identify with it. But the great thing is having that history, it's really fun to bring that into the characters because it's fun to act out an anxiety that was so full of fear when I was younger, but to act it out now and play with it, that's pretty cool.
Can you think of an example where you drew on your own anxiety to play the character?
I think with anxiety, it's not necessarily always like a panic attack. You know, as we all know, it's not like a full-fledged panic attack. Many times it's that silent prison that you put yourself in, where you're just standing there in the tension and the awkwardness and the what-ifs in your head and the chaos in your head. And with Gary on Veep, he many times just sits in that tension. And you can see so much is going on in his head, but he can't say anything. He can only react. But he's just, you can tell it's just something's about to explode in his head. And I love bringing that. You know, it's not this like, and running around and losing your mind. And I mean, sometimes anxiety can play that way out, but many times it's just you're kind of sitting in it and it's terrifying. And so I think I do that a lot with Gary. And also to add to that, I remember watching my two guys that I watched growing up were Tim Conway and Bob Newhart. I loved those guys. And they never pushed the comedy. They would always just sit in that tension. They would sit in that awkwardness. And so, because I think in life, that's kind of what we do sometimes. Like if chaos is happening around us, sometimes it's not always like, wah, run for the hills. Everybody just kind of gets really quiet and gets really still, but there's a lot going on in the head.
Yep,
you know?
Yep.
And I like bringing that to Gary.
So you were talking earlier about living in this, like, what's next kind of anxiety.
Yeah.
Are you, like, more secure as a person now?
Oh, that I attribute to therapy. I mean, yes, with certain jobs, I've become a lot more comfortable in my craft. But I think, honestly, it relates to also, sorry if I'm, like, going on tangents, but it also relates to kind of fame. You know, I think people look at, I think the base of fame is everybody wants to be known, honestly. And people look at fame as that's like the ultimate being known. And whoever's famous, man, they've got their crap together. But in actuality, if you're known by people who love you and you're known, that's all the known you need. And actually, people who are famous and have a lot of people know them, that can actually make you less known personally, because a lot of factors are involved in that. So it's that sense of, yeah, I might have confidence professionally, like I might be more comfortable in front of the camera. I might, since I've had all this experience, I'm a lot more comfortable in kind of the craft of it. But in terms of personal value and personal growth and personal confidence, that's a whole other game. That's whole other just a journey of healing in my life or whatever, and having friends around me who support me and love me, and me seeing the value in that the most value in that. I think that's a different game.
So one more question. When you get your script,
please.
Each time you get a new script for Veep, is the first thing that you look at how many lines you have or how many times you appear on camera? Do you just kind of skim it for your name?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. I think selfishly, there is a part of you that goes, huh, what's Gary doing in this episode? I'm just curious. And then I kind of go back and read the whole story. Yeah, totally. I'm not proud of that, but
it makes sense to me.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, I'm really, Gary's a sweet little guy, and I'm curious what kind of circumstances they're giving him. They put him through a lot.
Well, I really enjoy watching you, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Tony Hale plays Gary Walsh on the HBO series Veep. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday. For years, writer Sarah Heppala relied on alcohol to give her what she saw as the adventurous sex life of a strong, liberated woman. But when she gave up alcohol, she had to figure out what she really wanted. Note to parents, we're talking about sexual attitudes, not acts.
I stopped drinking at the age of 35, roughly 2 decades into my sex life. I was scared to quit for a lot of reasons. I thought I'd be boring. I thought other people would be boring. When you drink as long and lovingly as I did, you'll find a lot of excuses not to hang up your beer mug. But nothing frightened me as much as sex without alcohol. As in, no way, not happening. I've always been self-conscious about my body. In high school, I would have worn a scuba suit to pool parties if I could have gotten away with it. Some mixture of shyness, early puberty, and a Hollywood beauty warp kept me in hiding for many years. But alcohol pulled me out into the crowd. This is the eternal story of alcohol, liquid courage. Although it's acquired something of a modern twist for women. In Peggy Ornstein's book, Girls and Sex, the veteran journalist describes how young women today rely on booze to stay down with a hookup culture which increasingly takes its cues from porn. I can't speak for anybody else, but if I'm going to be giving a lap dance, someone better bring tequila. I applied the same logic to anything around sex. Scared to be seen naked? Drink. Scared he doesn't like you? Drink. Scared you don't like him? Ooh, honey, drink up. In my 20s, I longed to be one of those marauding females who had one-night stands and didn't demand anything girly in return, like commitment or phone calls. But being that vulnerable with another person, a real human person whose last name I probably did not know, was so confounding to my native sensitivity that alcohol was really the only way I could power through. And I wanted to like casual sex. I saw it as part of the necessary toolkit for being a woman of interest. These days, in pop culture, drinking and promiscuity has become a power brand, embraced by female heroines from Carrie Bradshaw to Amy Schumer. Drinking and sex make for an appealing rebellion, a pushback to centuries of female repression. And it doesn't hurt that guys like girls who drink and let loose. Of course, when casual sex becomes the norm, it feels a little less rebellious and a little more mandatory. Drunken hookups are so normalized among single people in their 20s and 30s and beyond that opting out of them can make you feel like an enemy of sexual freedom. It can make you feel like, yes, that old slur, like a prude. When I quit drinking, That's exactly what I feared I'd become. One of those dull women who ordered seltzer at the party and would probably never dance on a table again. I stayed in my hidey hole for more than a year, and I had an imaginary love affair with a barista named Johnny. Sometimes the little things get you through. I began to inch back into the dating world, slower than I wanted, but more confident with each passing month. And what I noticed was how much I actually cared about physical intimacy. I'd spent all these years trying to detach myself and pretend none of it was a big deal. But my experience was leading me to the opposite conclusion. Sex was a big deal to me. Around this time, I was listening to a Fresh Air interview with the comedian Louis C.K., and he said, "If you're intimate with a total stranger, it's a reckless thing to do." He talked about how strange and wrong it felt for him to be that close to someone he didn't know, and I felt validated, in part because Louis C.K. is the great philosopher-comedian of our time, but also because here was a man, a straight dude, the kind whose emotional detachment from sex I'd been trying to imitate to prove I was down. And he was saying casual sex didn't live up to the hype either. Over the past couple years, I've been more open about my feelings on this topic, and I think it makes people more open in return. I've spoken to friends who agree with me and plenty who don't. They like casual sex. It scratches an itch. It's fun. They might be straight or gay, male or female, but the more I hear people speak honestly about what they want in the bedroom, the more insane it seems to me that any one way of being would fit us all. Conformity and sexuality do not mix. It's like demanding that everyone be the same height. Giving up alcohol did not end my sex life. You could argue it made it more thrilling. There's something rare and radical about daring to be fully present and fully revealed to another person. It scares the hell out of me sometimes. But the fear of vulnerability is part of the price of real connection. Sex is a journey outside our comfort zones. And the trick is making sure that in that exploration, we feel safe. I don't know how you'll get there. Sometimes I don't know how I will either. But I can promise the best way to power through isn't alcohol. It's paying attention to your own wants and desires and being true to them.
Sarah Heppala is the author of the memoir Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. It was recently published in paperback. We've become increasingly aware of the suffering of animals in factory farms. Many people become vegetarians to do their part to spare animals from slaughter. But when it comes to fish, well, most people don't think about fish as having feelings. A new book makes the case that they do. It's called What a Fish Knows, and it's written by our next guest, Jonathan Balcom, the director of animal sentience at the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy. Sentience is the capacity to experience feelings. Balcom examines the scientific evidence that fish experience pain, have memory, and are capable of learning. He says, thanks to the breakthroughs in ethology, sociobiology, neurobiology, and ecology, we can now better understand what the world looks like to fish, how they perceive, feel, and experience the world.
Jonathan Balcom, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
So you say the capacity to feel, to suffer pain, to experience joy, that those are the bedrocks of ethics, and that that's what qualifies one for the moral community. So do fish feel? Do they suffer? Do they experience joy? Do they have emotions? I mean, how can we tell if they have emotions? It's because it's not like they purr or that they cuddle with us or that they rub up against us for attention like our pets do.
Well, actually, some of them do. You can go into reef areas where there are large groupers who've been living there for years, decades in some cases, and it's a safe area where there's, say, no fishing or spear fishing, and they become trusting, and they will approach trusted divers. Whether they're recognizing them as individuals, I don't know, but there was a new study this week showing recognition of human faces by fishes. So they probably do recognize individual divers, and they come up to be stroked. They like to be petted. It is almost like a dog. And I don't know that they roll over to have their belly petted, although some sharks will be sent into what looks like an euphoric state when they have their bellies rubbed. And I just watched a video the other day of a couple of intrepid divers rubbing the faces of tiger sharks. These guys go in the water regularly with sharks. They're on a mission. And the tiger sharks appear to love it. And you can also measure internal physiological changes, endorphins and pleasure compounds in the bloodstream. And you can measure cortisol, which shows that an animal is stressed. There's one study I really like of surgeon fishes where they stressed them. I felt bad for the fishes in this study, although I'm happy to say they returned them to the Great Barrier Reef when they were done. But they stressed them for half an hour, and then they gave them the opportunity to swim up next to a wand, which was modeled on a cleaner fish, which moved back and forth and could give them caresses. And when they were stressed, they would go right up and sidle up next to that wand and receive these caresses from this model. And they could measure that the stress hormones went significantly down. Fishes who were had an ability to swim up next to a model that wasn't moving and therefore couldn't deliver caresses was ignored. They didn't swim up to that and they didn't show declining stress. So there are clever ways of studying internal states of animals, fishes included.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around somebody tickling a shark's belly. Like, who would be doing that? Okay. So how can we tell if fish feel pain? I mean, we're used to, some kind of cry or scream from an animal if they experience pain. And if the fish is making a sound, we're probably not hearing it.
Yes, some people still question whether fish feel pain. Really, there's no question in my mind based on the evidence that I've looked at. And I've looked at this quite extensively in my research for this book. A number of studies have been done on trout, very detailed, meticulous studies in the lab where the animals are terminally anesthetized and then different anatomy was found. They have pain receptors that are sensitive to heat, to different chemicals, and different sensors to mechanical, such as piercing sorts of pain. And these signals are sent to the brain, and they affect the hormones in the animals. They affect the behavior. The animals change their behavior. They may stop eating. There's one other study I think I'd like to describe to you, though. I think it's, for want of a better word, the most elegant study of fish pain that I've ever seen. It was done a few years ago by a biologist named Lynn Snedden, who's in the UK. And she used zebrafishes, which are very commonly used in research. And what they did was they put a group of zebrafishes, I don't remember how many, perhaps 30, in a complex tank that had two chambers. One chamber was enriched. It had rocks and vegetation. And the other chamber was barren. It was open. And you can probably guess which chamber these fishes spent all their time in. It was the enriched one. Fishes like places to hide. They like stimulation in their environments. And then they injected fishes either with one of two things. One was with an acid solution, which is known to be caustic and presumably painful to these fishes, if they can feel pain. And then the other ones, the other half of the fishes were randomly selected, were injected with saline, which causes just the pierce of the needle, and then the pain is not going to be lasting because it's not acidic. And then they watched to see how they behaved, and they all remained swimming in the enriched tank. And then they dissolved a painkiller solution in the barren, undesirable chamber of this complex tank. And lo and behold, some of the fishes then started to migrate across and swim and hang out in that normally undesirable tank. And it was only the ones injected with the acid and not the ones injected with the saline. So I find that a pretty convincing demonstration of pain in fishes.
The Humane Society, where you work, publishes a journal about animal sentience, animals' ability to feel. And you're an associate editor of that. It recently published an article about whether fish can feel pain. The article said they don't. And then there was this long, long number of dissenting opinions, including one of yours, that came afterwards. So is this a big debate now in the scientific community?
Well, you could say it's a big debate in a paper like that, and responses are being published in the current era. I don't think it is a big debate for the simple reason that there are very few scientists who are actively arguing that fishes do not feel pain. I think if you surveyed scientists, the great majority would say, yes, of course they feel pain. They're a member of the vertebrate clan. They have all of the physiological, behavioral attributes that we would expect of an animal that can feel pain. And yes, as you say, the great bulk of responses to that article were rebuttals. And the primary argument being made by the gentleman who wrote that paper is that they lack a neocortex, the sort of cauliflower structure sort of part of our brain that's found in the mammals. And that's, I think, the crux of what weakens that argument is it is only found in the mammals. Birds don't have a neocortex. Their very effective brains evolved in a different path, and it's the paleocortex that became the sort of thinking part of their brain. And yet nobody's really debating whether birds can feel pain, never mind that they can also learn language and they can do a lot of other sophisticated things. And one of the things I try to show in this book is that fishes really deserve equal consideration to all the other vertebrates. When you look at the cumulative evidence we now have, it's quite clear to me that they are full members of the vertebrates and they deserve the same sort of respect that we accord mammals and birds when we're at our best.
So what's the next step? If fish deserve, you know, equal moral consideration, what are the implications of that?
They're huge, of course. Depending on who's doing the estimate, we humans kill between 150 billion and over 2 trillion fishes a year. If you line them up end to end, they'd reach the sun and back at the higher estimate. So the numbers are astronomical. And the way they die, certainly in commercial fishing, is really pretty grim. They die most often from suffocation in air, but also getting crushed in these huge fishing nets when they're drawn up. Decompression. Fishes have swim bladders, which are very useful for them, adding buoyancy, but they expand as the pressure drops when the fishes are being raised to the surface, and that can crush or neighboring organs or push things out of their mouths. That's probably not a very nice way to die either. And then sometimes there may be bled out on the deck, which is perhaps a little faster, but probably not very, very pleasant for them. So there's a lot of change that we can do. There's a lot of change that would be needed to reflect an improvement in our relationship with fishes.
So fish experience pain. We're actually, the fishing industry has some very probably painful ways of catching fish.
Yeah, it's not pleasant for them. You know, nets, trawlers that go along the bottom, which are just rapacious. It's been likened to running a bulldozer over a rainforest if you had a big enough bulldozer. And there's this awful issue of bycatch, which are unwanted species that are caught by these largely indiscriminate nets and catching methods, and they get all crushed in there as well. And so they're either dying or dead when they reach the deck in many cases. Very few of bycaught animals survive if they're tossed back, which is routinely the case. They are typically tossed back into the oceans.
So I think a question people ask themselves if they ask, do fish feel? Should we consider fish in our moral universe? They'd likely ask themselves, are fish smart? I mean, do they have intelligence? Is that like an appropriate question to ask? We talked a little bit about the controversy in science that you say is pretty much resolved about whether fish are intelligent. And you say most scientists now think that they are, that they have some intelligence. Should that matter when we're thinking morally about how we treat fish?
I think it's relevant. You can certainly find parallels between intelligence or brain capacity and sentience. I think that may be fair, but I mean, sentience is like pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not. You're either sentient or you're not. And if an animal is sentient, which means some kind of conscious awareness, but particularly the capacity to feel pain, and I would say by extension to feel pleasure, then to me that means that animal has moral traction, or it should have moral traction, that the animal is deserving of consideration of others, because that animal can have a good day and a bad day and can have good or bad things happen to them. And that's, as I say, the bedrock of ethics.
Okay, so let's look at whether fish have intelligence. First of all, like, how do they perceive? Like, we have 5 senses: vision, smell, hearing, touch, and taste. Fish live underwater. What do they have to perceive the world around them?
Yeah, they have all those 5. We also have a number of others that we don't include on that vaunted list of 5 that we really probably should. A sense of balance, a sense of pleasure, a sense of pain. We've been talking about that. They have all of those as well. But they have a couple of other pretty neat senses that are worth mentioning. One is a sense of water pressure or movement in the water that's very acute thanks to a lateral line. We're talking about bony fishes now, not the sharks and rays, which are in a separate group, the cartilaginous fishes, which have really cool adaptations as well. well. But the bony fishes have a lateral line. You may notice a dark row of scales along the center line of a bony fish, and that's actually the shadow cast by these specialized scales because there's a depression in each one. And in that depression are specialized little cup-like chambers with gel in them and little hairs that stick out, and they detect pressure changes. So it's very useful for navigating at night, for avoiding dangerous things in limited vision conditions and that sort of thing. Another really cool sense is electrical. Some fishes, including sharks and I think rays as well, are electroreceptive. They can detect electrical signals from other organisms. But there's also electric-producing fishes. The knife fishes of South America and the elephant nose fishes, named for a long projection on their faces, of Africa, appropriately, they're both electric-producing. So they have EODs, which are electric organ discharges, and they use those as communication signals, and they communicate in some pretty cool ways. They will change their own frequency if they're swimming by another fish with a similar frequency so they don't jam and confuse each other. They also show deference by shutting off their EODs when they're passing by a territory holder. You don't want to piss off the territory holder, so it's probably better to sort of go quote-unquote silent during that time. So the perceptions and sensory abilities of fishes, well, they're the product of over 400 million years of evolution, so it might not surprise us that they've got some pretty cool ways of sensing their environments.
So you say that fish can hear and that they make sounds. They're underwater, we're on land, so I don't know if divers hear any sounds underneath, but what kind of sounds do they make, and what are some of the ways they make those sounds?
Yeah, I have a list of words that I couldn't resist stringing together somewhere in the book. You know, clicks, pops, rasps, buzzes, burrs, purrs. I forget the other ones. I think there were about 15 or 20 words on that list. It is quite a symphony of different sounds they can make. They're not necessarily really tonal sounds. Some of them are, and some fishes are named for the sounds they make. Grunts, for instance, and I think toadfish is maybe named for that, although they maybe look a bit like toads, but there certainly are quite a few fishes named for their sounds. They produce them in different ways. Some fishes grind their teeth together. Some fishes grind their bones together. Limb movements, I think, may be used in some cases. And the swim bladder I mentioned earlier is quite useful for making sounds. You know, we use our lungs as an air producer, so swim bladders have gas in them and they can be rubbed and air can be expelled or gases can be expelled. And so swim bladders are often involved in sound. There is one really curious example, though, involving herrings that I can't resist mentioning. I think if you were to come up with a phrase that best captures it, at least a delicate phrase, flatulent communication would be perhaps the right phrase. They live in big schools and they appear to use, they emit gases from the anus in large numbers and it makes a sound, and they appear to use this as a communication device to maybe to signal to others that it's time we moved up or down in the water column because it's that time of day when the predators are coming out and this sort of thing. And the researchers who studied it used the more technical term frequent repetitive ticks. And I'll leave it to the listener to make an acronym out of that, which is quite appropriate to the behavior.
Oh, that's very funny. Okay. So since you firmly believe that fish have the capacity to feel, that they have intelligence, that they feel pain, and that we therefore shouldn't punish them, what do you think of fish as pets?
Well, they're lovely to look at, and they're graceful and beautiful. And I get a lot of stories from people, anecdotes of people who live with fishes and become very attached to them. And the relationship is touching and often moving, and they maybe span a decade or more. So definitely there's some lovely parts of the relationship between captive fishes and their humans if they're well looked after. Having said that, there's certainly problematic areas of the whole aquarium industry itself. The aquarium industry is very, actually quite disturbing in terms of the capture of wild fishes, mostly from reefs, because that's where the beautiful, colorful little ones that are so popular in reefs are particularly sought after. Some of the methods used to catch them are pretty awful. Cyanide poisoning, which often kills many of the fishes being targeted or ones that are not being targeted. And explosive devices are sometimes used. And then you have the vicissitudes of transport where they're shipped over continents. And the mortality rates are quite high. One of my affiliate organizations, Humane Society International, which is under the umbrella of the Humane Society of the U.S., for whom I work, they have an active campaign now to draw attention to the Blue Tang, which is the star of the sequel to Finding Nemo, the new film Finding Dory, which, by the way, my book was strategically timed to come out around the same time as. And Dory is a blue tang, and they are going to be probably very popular in the aquarium trade because of the fact that this film will draw a lot of attention to that species. Well, unfortunately, blue tangs are caught in the wild, and they are subject to some of the ills of the industry. And so we are campaigning actively to try to discourage people from buying these fishes, because when you purchase a product, you tell the manufacturer to do it again, and we don't really want that happening.
Jonathan Balcombe, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thank you for having me.
Jonathan Balcombe is the author of the new book, What a Fish Knows. He spoke with Terry last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculi.
Out on the sea, we'd be forgiven. Our body stopped, the spirit living. Wouldn't you lie?